Well, we have this quarter, I've entitled our talks together as Family, the Shadow of Things to Come. And my original thought was that what I think is, I think we're preparing to go to heaven. And I think that living on this earth is kind of like there are some things that are shadows of things to come after when we get to heaven. And I'm thinking that the family is something like that. When studying my lesson for today, I came upon a disturbing thought that kind of stopped me in mid-stride, that it occurred to me that there are probably some people in this audience who are listening to me and saying, well, if you take a look at my family, and my family is just a shadow of things to come, then I'd sure hate to see the real thing. Well, that's a legitimate thought, is it not? So I wanted to just talk about families for a few minutes this evening, or this morning, and see if we can make sense out of it. One thing I did right out of college, well, I married Lindy right at the end of college. And then right after that, I took a job at a state prison working as a prison counselor. And it's a medium security prison. It's a farm in Tennessee, a prison farm. And they had about 900, I think, inmates there. And so my job was to interact with all of them, or some of them. And then right after that, I quit that job and went to be a child protective services worker, like a social worker with the Department of Human Services there in Tennessee. And my job there was to check up on complaints of abuse and neglect of children. And then I worked there for a little while and then took a job as a juvenile probation officer with the Department of Corrections there in Tennessee. And my job there was to sit in Judge Bean's office on Tuesday mornings, sit in his court, and listen to these little outlaw kids get adjudicated for different things. And then my job was to keep up with them and make sure they did right after that. And then I did that for a while, and then I took a job with the county. The county, I can't remember that guy's name who was governor at the time. Anyway, he made some money available for these Just Say No programs. That was the late 80s in drug prevention. That's what he was trying to do in the schools. And so I got hired in that county to do that. And my job was to go talk to 52 classrooms of 3rd, 4th, and 5th, and 6th graders every month and try to get them to not use drugs. And then as part of that, I developed some groups of high schoolers and junior hires who would go into those little people's classroom and say the same thing to them, try to influence them to the good. I don't know if we ever did prevent drugs among the kids, but what we did do is help the high schoolers and junior hires. Wasn't that an interesting thought? They had somebody looking at them all the time, so they were afraid to do wrong. Well, after that, I moved here and took a job as in an addictions treatment place. And so my job now is kind of, I'm not a counselor, but kind of an administrator of counseling centers and things like that. So all of my adult career, I guess, since for, 20-something years, 25 or 6 or 7 years, I've my whole focus seems to be in looking at families that are all torn up, not working very well. And there's been a lot of study on family dynamics. Just books and books and books have been written on family dynamics and that sort of thing. And typically it's studying families that are sick. Like if you, for instance, if you take a look at all the famous psychologists in the world, Freud and Adler and bunch of, and all those guys, there's most of them studied sick people and tried to figure out what made them sick. Only one that I know of, Maslow, studied well people and tried to figure out what made them well. Well, but it, isn't it typical, though, that we would look at sick things and try to make them well, try to figure out what makes them sick? Well, that's the same thing that's happened here with the family. And what they, those who study such things have come up with is a term that probably didn't happen, didn't exist before. It's called dysfunction. You ever heard of that term? Well, I've heard it so much I'm sick of it, but a dysfunctional family is the term for it. And if we describe a dysfunctional family and describe a family that's that the type that I've been working with forever, you take a look at all the now that is distracting. How in the world did that happen? You can't turn that off, can you, Robert? All right, I'll try to ignore it. That guy looking. Okay. I'll be looking at that. What's that guy saying? Let's see. Fathers. All right, typically in a family, there's a father. And if you got a dysfunctional family, either he's real mean or he's absent. All right, so you got an overbearing father, or a father that you can't ever please, or somebody who's way too demanding, expects perfection out of their kids. Or you got a father who sits in his easy chair and reads the newspaper and lets the whole world go by and is not there at all. So typically there's the dad in a dysfunctional family. And then you got your mama, and she is either real dominant, maybe because the dad's absent, or she's over permissive, just lets everything happen. And so when I was a probation officer, I had a kid who was sixth grade, 12 years old, in court for truancy. He wouldn't go to school. And the judge asked the mama, she was there. They lived in a little housing project there in that little town. And she says, "Why is this boy not going to school?" And she says, "I just can't get him up." And he's 12 years old. And so my job was to go get that boy up in the morning and make him go to school. So I went over there. I said, "Boy, get up." And he got up. And he went on to school. Well, but his mama couldn't make that happen. She just was absolutely helpless to make that boy get up. And so that was a dysfunctional family where the boy ran the family. Then we got, if you have kids then in a dysfunctional family, generally you have one who maybe is the oldest. We'll just say he or she is the oldest. And lots of times they end up typically are the hero. So this person is the person who tries to be perfect all the time. And we've got to be overachiever, superachiever. We've got to be excellent at what we do. We've got to make our people proud of us. We've got to uphold the family image. We've got to do all this regardless of what else is going on in the family. We've got to be really good. That's not always the oldest person, but sometimes typically it is. Well, if you have another kid, they might end up being the rebel. You know, the black sheep guy. So, have you ever seen families where one guy tends to turn out perfect and the other guy goes exactly opposite direction? Well, what in the world is that all about? Well, this is the guy who doesn't care anything about, authority. Not interested in putting up with authority. Smarter than everybody else. And so this person, it kind of rejects everything. And so they're off going crazy and wild. There was The most tragic thing that I saw happen, I guess, when I was a probation officer was this boy had been put in a group home because his people were mean to him. But he heard that his mama had just gone up to his dad on the couch and she had a shotgun, so she shot him and killed him. And then she told the daughter to tell the police that the daughter had killed the dad because the daughter's underage and she won't get in trouble. And she's supposed to tell the police that her daddy was abusing her, so that's why she shot him. And then the boy heard about that, so he ran away from the group home, went and stole his dad's pickup truck, and was flying down the road and hit a bank and went through a fence and killed himself there. That all happened within about 24 hours. So that's the end result of this kind of a dysfunctional family type deal. Well, there's a rebel, but then there's also the family dynamics folks call him a lost child. This is a little old guy that sits there and reads all the time. You don't even know he's there. He or she is not going to make any noise because make noise, you rock the boat, you know, and you don't want to really make waves in this family because there's turmoil enough. So you end up being real quiet and timid and that sort of thing. And so, there are comedians in dysfunctional families, and their job is to keep the peace. And they keep the peace by making everybody laugh. And if something bad's going on here, and if I can make everybody start laughing, they'll forget about what's going on bad and quit fighting and fussing and everything. And so my job, if I'm the comedian then, is to make that happen. And people get really good at all these things. Like, comedians are really funny. And they're not just funny in their family. They're funny everywhere, and people really like them. And inside, the little old comedian's saying, well, if I wasn't funny, you wouldn't like me. And so he's got to stay funny all of his life. Well, would anybody mind raising your hand if you didn't hear something that describes some of your family? Y'all are all dysfunctional. Every one of us are. Isn't that something? Well, unless you didn't raise your hand, and you should have. Well, and then you're dysfunctional. Well, then you add, if you add any addictive substances into this mix, it turns out really bad. If you got a dad or a mom who's drinking a lot, or kids who are doing dope, or mom and dads who are doing all kinds of pills or whatever, that arrests any kind of development that you might have, and it arrests any kind of growth that might happen in this family, and it sets up a lot of bad dynamics. And you get these things, like you have the guy who's drinking, let's say the dad's drinking a lot, well, he's called dependent. And then the mom, if she's got a conscience and she really wants to make her family work and all that, she will do the very best that she can to help that daddy stay drunk. And all the while she's thinking, I'm trying to get him sober. So let's say it's the mom then, and she's asked this old daddy to quit for a jillion times. But he's drunk this morning, can't go to work. So she'll call in his work and say, my husband's sick, he can't go. Or he'll come in at night and fall out drunk on the kitchen floor, and he'll throw up and everything. She'll help him to bed and clean up so that the kids won't see all that. And then the next day he doesn't remember it, but she does. So that's called codependent. So she's trying to control this guy. But if you'll notice, if this guy ever gets sober, they usually get divorced. Why is that? because she don't know how to be anything else. He gets sober, and then all of a sudden she's still trying to do everything that she was doing when he was drinking, and that sets up a whole other problem. So when we look at all of this right here, all that mess, it almost seems impossible to have a family that's worth a flip. Here's the trouble with overdiagnosing stuff like this. You be around that enough, and you study on it enough, and some negative things will start happening to your mind, or mine. It does mine. It is that we'll miss the cure when it comes around. If we find the cure, we'll miss it. Because we know too much about the problem. Children of Israel had snakes biting them. God said, Moses, build a brass serpent. And if you look at the snake, brass serpent, you'll get well. Well, Jim McGuigan theorized about a Israeli who's out one day picking up sticks, and he picks up a snake instead, and it bites him. And he takes a look at the bite, and he whips out his notepad and starts taking notes. All right, here's a snake. It's 3 feet long, got peculiar markings on its back, opens his mouth 2 inches wide. Tail looks a little darkish. And so he does a study of the snake, and he can tell you everything about the snake. And he can tell you, you know, how long it was, how big around it was. And then he takes a look at his wound and says, all right, now it looks to me like we've got a 1.5 centimeter wide between the puncture marks. Now they're turning a little bit white with a red dot where each of the punctures were. And it feels like it's swelling a little bit. My hand's starting to burn. And then he learns so much about this, he gets up a speech. And he goes around telling his buddies, say, man, I got bit. And look at here. Now my whole arm's starting to swell. I'm feeling a little bit woozy, and it's getting hard to breathe. Anybody with any sense would say, man, you're crazy. You need to go look at that snake. It is easy, brothers and sisters, to diagnose so much that our diagnosis becomes our identity. And then we'll miss the cure if it comes available to us. So we can't do that. It's good to know what's going on, but it's good, not good to make it our identity. Because I've seen this about 500 jillion times. You have a family in trouble, and you present an answer, and they won't do it. How come? I got to ask myself, why not? It's so clear. It's so logical. It makes so much sense. And the answer I finally came to is, if I get well, then who am I? It's like the rug salesman who only had one rug. He sat there day after day. Nobody bought his rug. Finally, somebody came in and said, I want to buy your rug. He said, it ain't for sale. I said, why not? He said, because I'm a rug salesman. If I'll sell you my rug, I'm out of business. Then who am I? If you're looking at it from the outside, it doesn't make a lick of sense. If you're looking at it from the inside, it makes all the sense in the world. Who am I then if I get well? Well, and also there's something called learned helplessness. Who was that that had the dogs? Pavlov? Pavlov. P-A-V-L-O-V, I think. He had some dogs. And this is back before the time when you couldn't do this kind of thing to dogs, when you could do things to dogs. All right, let's see. Put a dog in a cage. Left the door open. Cage was electrified. So Pavlov's standing over here, punches a button, electrifies the floor of the cage and shocks the dog. Dog runs out of the cage. And then he does it again. He puts the dog back in there, shocks him again. Dog runs out of the cage. And then Pavlov shut the door. Then he shocked him. Dog just busted his head on that door trying to get out of the cage. And he fought and he fought and finally settled down. Sat back down. Pavlov hit him again with the door shut. Dog, wham, hit the door trying to get out. Finally settled down. He did it again. Wham. But Pavlov did that so much that after a while, when Pavlov shocked this little old dog right here, you know what he did? He shocked him and he just sat there. He shocked him again, and he just sat there. Didn't flinch, didn't do anything. Then Pavlov opened the door. All right, there's your open door. Now, he shocked him one more time, and what'd the dog do? He sat there. He had an open door, and didn't even know it. The most massive slavery that ever happens in our lives is in our minds. The dog was as free as a bird to leave, but his mind was enslaved, and he wouldn't go because he learned that there was no way out. And then if a way out opens up, he doesn't believe it. All right, is anybody, you don't have to raise your hand, but is anybody in that situation with your family? Are you believing that there's really not much cure for this particular problem? We know a lot about dysfunctional families because we live in them. And we know a lot about them because there's been so much study done on them in the last 50 or so years. But did you also know that in families, we learn things like selflessness? We learn things like nobility. We learn things like laughing together, harmony, enjoying each other's company, eating together, doing for one another. Part of the story is the dysfunction. The rest of the story is not. I would like for us to, if you're hung up in that negative mindset about a family, I'd like for us to start developing a new image of what it might be, a new vision. And I'd like to start with this. Listen to this from Ezekiel 37. You can turn there if you'd like. But Ezekiel 37. Ezekiel was a prophet of God. And God did something very peculiar with Ezekiel. He said, "The hand of the Lord was on me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley, and it was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, the bones that were very dry. And he asked me, 'Son of man, can these bones live?' I said, 'O sovereign Lord, you alone know.' Well, then he said to me, 'Prophesy to these bones and say to them, Dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you, and make flesh come upon you, and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you, and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded, and as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the sovereign Lord says, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe into these slain that they may live. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them. They came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army. Then he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We're cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to him, this is what the sovereign Lord says. O my people, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I'll bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I'm the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from them. I will put my spirit in you and you will live. I'll settle you in your own land. Then you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken and I have done it, declares the Lord. Y'all believe that story? That's an impossible story. Do you believe it? Think that really happened? I think it did. I'm just going to believe it did. Can't prove it either way, so I'm just going to believe it did happen. What's that tell you about the power of God? What's it tell you? Nothing's impossible. Pardon me? He can do anything. Well, pardon me? He sure did. He can do anything. You think he can save your family? Is God's power reserved only for Old Testament prophets? Are those the only guys who could access him? If that's true, then why are we here? You think God can fix your family? I've got some suggestions. How do you start? You start by believing that it might really be true. Is there such a thing as a good family in the world? Sure there is. Sure there is. Well, who has them, people? Well, are you a people? Oh, yeah. Well, it's possible for you then. And it's possible for me to have good families. So, what is our approach? Well, you could look at it like, it's a lifelong process. Well, it certainly is. But should I then be praying to God for an easy path? What do you think? Path for an easy walk? Pardon me, Tyro? No maturity for the easy walk. I had some goats when I was little. My mama had some goats. And goats are fascinating critters. We had cows too, and they would be out on the hillside grazing. And those goats, especially when they were babies, would play king on the mountain on top of the cows. You ever seen that? Beat all I ever saw. hear the little old goat go bounce, bloop, land on a cow. And the cow didn't pay a bit of attention. That was the funniest thing. The cow sit there grazing, and the little old goat standing on top of the cow. Then here would come a little goat's brother. Go bloop, 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 wham, slam into that little goat, knock him off of there, and land on the cow. They did that over and over and over. Another time, we had a hay wagon that had, was more like a corn wagon, but it had sides on it. You know, here's your wagon bed, and then here's a little side stands up about a foot and a half. And then on the outside of that is a little old lip about an inch of board that stuck out below, I mean, beyond that side like that. Those little old goats would take a running start and land on that inch wide board. And they had a whole wagon bed to land on if they had wanted to. But no, they wanted to get walk along that inch of a board, and they'd just walk. You ever seen a goat on a cliff? They're amazing. They can run up and down cliffs that you can't even crawl over. They don't lose their footing. Do goats have an easy path? They don't even look for an easy path. They look for the hardest path they can find. Listen to what David said. In Psalm 18, he makes my feet like the feet of a deer, and he enables me to stand on the heights. First thing I'd like to suggest to you in making a good family happen in your life is don't ask God for an easy path, ask him for good feet. Ask him that our feet might be good to walk the path. Well, then I don't have to be blaming God for not making it easy on me. And also, I get to experience the inexpressibly valuable event of growth through effort. We bought some FFA chickens not too many years ago. Big old white fat chickens. These chickens had spent their lives, I think, in a box, sticking their head out, eating. They didn't walk at all. So I was used to a chicken that would do something if you tried to catch him or whatever. Well, we bought these chickens and took them home. First thing I did, I got him out of the box and I pitched him into the pen. And because the chicken's supposed to flutter and kind of break his fall, those chickens bounced like, well, I only did one that way. That'd been funny if I'd done them all. But those chickens, that one chicken bounced like a basketball. I've never seen the like in my life. I dropped him and he just wham, hit the ground. He didn't even try to flutter. He didn't know how. That chicken had an easy path all his life. And first coyote that came along ate him. I guess he did because he sure disappeared the next couple of days. And so the easy path is not the best path always. It really isn't. But if we ask God for good feet, we can walk the hard paths. We can walk the hard paths. That's one thing we can do. Psalm 81:16 talks about getting honey from rocks. You know, what I suggest to us is that God's in the rocks. And we'll get enough sweet out of it to get us through to another day. Our path, it's not that we don't have dysfunctional families. It's that we have hope, and it's that we have a God who's bigger than our families, and he's able to heal us and correct us. And here's the last thing. Ray Vanderlyn taught me so much about this Jewish culture. I talked about him a couple of weeks ago. But he did a field trip with some Jewish, he's in a rabbi school, I think, and he did field trip with them out into the countryside with some shepherds. And the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in what? Green pastures. So Ray Vanderlyn was out there on a hillside and he was watching the sheep. And it's a barren, arid landscape with not much green in it. And he was looking at these sheep eating, and it looked to him like they were eating rocks. And so he went over and investigated, and he looked down, and like in the crevice of the rock, down in there were some little bitty tufts of green grass. And that's what the sheep were eating. And they'd eat that little bunch, and then they'd go to another, and then go to another. And it hardly ever rains there, so apparently what happens is there's a westerly wind coming off the Mediterranean Sea that brings moisture in the evening, condenses on those rocks, drips down into the soil, and the little grass grows. And then the sun comes out in the morning, and by late afternoon, Vanderlyn said that grass is withered up and dried and gone. These sheep were eating those little bitty tufts of grass. Looked like they were eating rocks. So he asked a rabbi student who was from there, and he says, how do you describe this right here? He said, that's green pastures. The idea of the Lord making us lie down in lush alfalfa beside a flowing stream might not be the picture he was painting. Maybe God gives us enough green pasture for today. And then tomorrow he'll give us some more green pasture. It's like manna. You can't get enough today to last you till tomorrow. And it's like faith. It's hard to get enough today to last us through tomorrow. We've got to get another dose tomorrow. I think in our efforts to live an overcoming life and in our efforts to have good families, in our efforts to be upright people, God will give us enough for today. He'll give us the green pasture that we need right this minute. He'll give us good feet to walk the rough path. And he'll give us the victory over what we're trying to accomplish. Our job is, listen, have you ever heard this? Trust in the Lord with all your might. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he'll direct your path. Another place it says, thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. So not only will he give us good feet, he'll give us a light. So anyway, I really appreciate you listening to me this morning. Yes, Tyrone? Good old days when we were having the hardest time. Yeah. Thank you. Well, let's pray together. Lord, thank you for this assembly this morning. I thank you for each person in here, and I not only thank you for the blessings, I thank you for the struggles. I guess I thank you for the blessing of the struggle. Thank you for giving us an indication that you'll give us good feet to walk the rough path, and you'll give us light enough to see, and you'll give us enough green pasture to lead us through the day. And so that's really what we ask of you today, Lord, and thank you. Thank you for being our shepherd. And thank you for Jesus the Christ, whom we love and we want to worship and follow all our days. Please bless us through the day. In Christ's name, amen.